ubi solitudinem faciunt, pacem appellant.
That is the first Latin we've had on Read This, and it took us just 30 episodes and getting Mary Beard as a guest. You may well have heard of Mary Beard, even if you're not an obsessive ancient Rome aficionado. She is the expert in the field. She's written more than 20 books. Her 2015 SPQR is probably the one that broke her through to commercial stardom. But more recent ones are Emperor of Rome or 12 Caesars. In the UK, she's a rock star. She hosts shows on the BBC like Pompeii, Life and Death in a Roman Town, or Julius Caesar Revealed. So let's hear that Latin sentence one more time.
Ubi solitudinem faciunt, pacem appellant.
That is Mary Beard's life sentence, a half dozen words that set her on the path to becoming the world's foremost classicist. I'm Michael Williams, and this is Read This, a show about Et Libros Amamus et Fabulus Post Eos. My partner's father, Warren, is a brilliant man, but he has the daunting habit of grilling guests and family alike with arcane points of trivia and pop quizzes. And Mary Beard is up there in his personal reading pantheon. Your knowledge of the Roman Empire gets a decent workout in Warren's company. And while I've been reading and loving Mary Beard for years, and have been trying to keep my sandal and toga knowledge fresh, I have to confess that the bulk of my reading on Rome comes from Asterix comics. I don't always know my Pliny the Elder from my Pliny the Younger. Luckily, Mary Beard is in the business of making the ancient feel accessible without dumbing it down. Mary, do you meet people who automatically approach you with an intellectual inferiority complex, who are intimidated by your level of scholarship, your level of knowledge and reading? The classics are imposing, aren't they?
They are, and I used to notice that more when I was younger. The old kind of thing you get on a train, and it's a long journey, and someone would say, "What do you do?" And you'd say, "I'm a classicist." It didn't start a good conversation usually. So, well, I soon got to realise you said, "I'm an archaeologist."
Ah.
And if you said that, things opened up. And now, actually, I think, you know, I've been quite lucky because I've been on the telly and because what I do on the telly doesn't look posh. It doesn't look kind of as if this is all, I'm talking about things that you don't know about. You know, I now found my train journeys are much better, you know, and I can say, "Oh, yeah, you're Mary Beard who does the Romans." And I can say, "Yeah, I'm a classicist." And people think it's kind of cute rather than off-putting.
One of the things I love in 12 Caesars is you make the case that the interchangeability of emperors is a feature, not a glitch. That we are the ways in which they blend into one in our minds is a very deliberate function of their period. Can you explain that for us?
Yeah. If you go to a museum where there's a lot of Roman sculpture, let's say, you see how slightly anxious people are because they can't be certain that they can tell one emperor from another. And I used to be deeply afflicted by that. I used to think, I am just hopeless. You know, there are all these busts here and I can't tell Tiberius. And it wasn't really until, well, I've been teaching for a long time that I realised that's the point. You know, the point about the Roman emperor, you know, when he's recreated in marble, is that he looks like the other ones, or occasionally there are ruptures. But the other thing that I really like about them, and I think it would hugely help in our own culture wars and statue wars, is that they were very adept at one reign comes to an end, they've just got a new statue just made of Nero, let's say, and they think, oh gosh, we've got a new dynasty now, we've got Vespasian. They just get the hammer and chisel, and they turn the features of Nero into the features of Vespasian. And I think if only we'd thought of that, you know, that you don't need necessarily to pull statues down. You can leave them up, but you can adjust them.
Chip away, a different chin line.
Chip away, make it a different, give him a different hairstyle, give him a different label underneath. And they see, quite unlike us, I think, they see statues as works in progress. You know, you can take the head off if you like, put another one on. You know, you can add something to, you know, give him something to hold in the hand. And that seems to me to be a whole level of imagination that we just haven't recreated. We're a bit over-serious about statues, I think.
One of the things I so love about your work is this internal ambivalence between a deep admiration for certain facets of ancient Roman society on the one hand, and on the other, a deep scepticism. Yeah. You know, you're at pains to stress. You're not studying this because you love ancient Rome.
That's right. I mean, people always come up and they say, oh, you must love the Romans. And you think, what? You know, I mean, I think that you can find people interesting, you know, for decades without liking the bastards. But I think what is so interesting about the Romans is that kind of ambivalence between them being, we can barely begin to make sense of in our horror. You know, what would it be like to sit and watch people being put to death in the gladiatorial arena? You know, people say, we shouldn't judge the past. Well, maybe we should sometimes and say that is really awful and wonder what enabled them to do it. And yet you can put that together with finding them just so smart about things in a way that surprises you. You know, they can talk about themselves in a way that is jaw-dropping sometimes. Mm.
We've already touched on the way people perceive the classics in a particular way, and it can sometimes be seen as synonymous with a glorification of empire.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a lot of things are all mixed up into one, I think, in people's assumptions about people who study the ancient world. And part of that, I think, in any Western culture is that classics was used as a gatekeeper for the elite. You know, how better to define an elite cadre of little boys than teach them a language no one speaks? It is, you know, absolutely classic gatekeeping practice. And people of colour were kept out, women were kept out. But I think that that then goes together with the idea that that culture legitimated empire ever after, and that what the British Empire was doing was providing a justification for itself by looking back to the stories of the Roman Empire, that all those guys who were busy exploiting the empire, all the stories that they had learnt at school. Right? And so there was a neat circle and a join-up between class, privilege, and the exploitation of the empire. And I think some of that is right. What it ignores, I think, is that when there were debates in the 19th century in England, as there were, but we forget this, you know, we think of them all as jingoistic imperialists. No, they weren't. They were busy talking about what the imperial project was, whether it was justifiable. And you look and you see the people involved in both sides are coming from the ancient world. You know, you can see these guys on the Manchester Guardian, you know, in the 1870s and 80s, and they're actually an anti-imperial newspaper, straight down the line. And they're kind of trying to recruit from people who'd read classics at Oxford and Cambridge. Because in some ways, the point about classics is that it's never quite as easy to pin down as that simple characterization of it would suggest.
To what extent is the study of classics almost entirely about the art of reading and rereading the same fixed points, the same fixed texts, again and again for reinterpretation, to better understand? Because surely the core material is more or less unchanging.
One of the real pleasures about it for me is not just, let's say, reading Virgil. It's reading a text that I know people have been reading ever after. I mean, Virgil's Aeneid. I could not prove what I'm going to say, but I'm sure it's true. Virgil's Aeneid is a text that has been read by somebody every day since Virgil almost finished it. And okay, they've mostly been men and they've been privileged people, but it is a text which actually joins up, literally joins up in the experience of reading us and people in the 18th century, in medieval monasteries, and in the ancient world itself. And I find that hugely pleasurable, to think that I'm sharing something. It's very hard to share an experience with people in the past, but you can share the experience of reading in a way that you can't share the experience of, you know, medicine. And so I find that very challenging and simultaneously challenging and reassuring, I think. But also I like the idea that those texts, some of them at least, are so hard. And, I mean, people, they do find it, to start with, I think, puzzling, that they can't read it. Like, they can, you know, you learn French, and after you've done a bit of French, you can pick up a French novel and you can read it pretty much like you can read an English novel.
Yeah.
I've never been able to do that with Latin, or certainly not with Greek. And to some extent, you think, and this might be right, that I'm just not good enough. But I think that really it is. The texts that we are constantly returning to are very, very hard. If you look at something like Tacitus's Annals, the history of the early emperors, that would have seemed as weird to them as we find reading James Joyce.
Yeah.
Reading James Joyce is really hard. We're kind of confronted by language doing something that we didn't think language ought to do, right? And that's the same with certainly Tacitus's Annals. You go back to the Greek 5th century, Thucydides's History of the Peloponnesian War. We still can't translate it because it's any more than, you know, imagine translating Finnegan's Wake into French. I mean, somebody no doubt has tried, but it would be an issue that was right at the very limits of what language can do. And in part, I think both Thucydides, and these are two historians, of course, but both Thucydides and Tacitus, they're not just kind of using language in a difficult way perversely, any more than Joyce was being perverse in Finnegan's Wake. They're using a kind of confrontation with language behaving badly, really, which is what it is, to start to think about how do you write about a system that is corrupt.
Yeah. And I mean, I know Tacitus for you is a really important part of your own reading. He was a kind of crucial moment for you as a working class girl coming up through the classics to say, wait a minute, they weren't all triumphalist. They weren't all telling a history of success.
No. And that's actually where my life sentence comes from.
Oh, go on, give it to us.
Because it was the kind of light bulb moment when I understood that the Romans weren't quite as imperialistic and jingoistic as I'd thought. You know, that I was at school and I must have been about 14, and I was at an academic girls' school, and, you know, yeah, I was 14 and I was reading Tacitus. I was reading Tacitus's biography of his father-in-law, Agricola. One of his easier works, actually.
What a slouch you were, Mary dear.
I was a slouch. And towards the end of this account of Agricola's life story, there's an account of a battle between Agricola's Roman forces and the forces of the Brits. And as in many Roman or Greek histories, you know, the battle starts, sure, almost entirely fictionally, with the pep-up talk to the troops on both sides. And Calchagus is scripted by Tacitus. And Tacitus had no idea what this guy in North Britain said in 83. I'm absolutely certain he had no idea. He's giving him a version of what it is like to be a barbarian enemy under Rome. And at one point, he's saying, look, what do the Romans do? You know, they're robbers, they're thieves, huge denunciation of empire. And then he says, and they make a desert and they call it peace. Ubi solitudinem faciunt, pacem appellant. And I remember reading this, you know, they make a kind of, they make destitution, they make a scorched earth. And then they give it the name of peace when they've done it. And it was the first time, although I was sort of good at Latin, it was the first time any bit of Latin had ever spoken to me. You know, it actually said, there's a point here, and it's not just a point about Calgagus and Agricola, and the barbarians in the end, of course, are going to get thrashed, I'm afraid. It's a point about us. You know, this was the time of the Vietnam War, and they make a desert and call it peace. You do it in five words, and you're speaking about now, as much as about 83 CE. And I think it was those few words which convinced me that I could go on with these guys.
Yeah.
Because they were so smart about their own faults.
When we return, Mary reveals the true lessons that we can learn from the ancient Roman Empire. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Emily Barrett, Managing Editor of the Saturday Paper. Every week, I work with our writers on journalism that often ends up as part of the news on 7am. But there's much more to the Saturday Paper than what you hear on this show. There's commentary, arts coverage, food, fashion, science, and health. To get the most from Australia's leading independent newspaper, subscribe at thesaturdaypaper.com.au. The Saturday Paper, the whole story.
There's nowhere like the monthly. Long-form journalism that doesn't just respond to the news cycle, it shapes it. Subscribe today from just $7.25 at themonthly.com.au/subscribe. The Monthly, Australia's only news magazine.
Part of the project of Emperor of Rome, it seems to me, is explicitly to suggest the ways in which we've misunderstood the nature and the role of emperor as a position.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we've thought about them as individual characters, mostly bad, you know, somewhere on the spectrum from psychopath to just a bit dotty, occasionally interspersed with someone trying to do his best. And we have been very one down the road, which the ancient writers, I think, encourage us to go down in a way of thinking that what you need to do is you've got to get their biography straight. You've got to see these as individuals with a story. And the only way to understand them is to know the story. And you've got to know why this one has a different story from that one. I mean, one of the things I wanted to say is, look, most emperors are very similar. Sure, they have their different characteristics, but they're much more similar than they are different. And if we think about them as people doing the same job from the same place with the same staff and the same resources, we then start to see something much more clearly about, I think, the terror in part of the Roman Empire, but also the mundane working life of these guys. Now, what is interesting is that they spent their time in their filing cabinets going through their intray, but they were written about as if they were having sex in the swimming pool and showering people with rose petals. That's where you get to the problem.
It is one of my favourite things about your approach is that you kind of take us by the hand and you say, if you're asking, are these stories true? You're asking the wrong question. These stories have survived.
Yeah.
And so the fact that they've survived, the fact that they were the ones that were told, is what makes them interesting.
That's exactly right. And I think, you know, I was brought up when I was a student and then actually my early academic career, I thought the most important thing was to kind of try and work out which of these were true, which of these were flagrantly untrue, and which were a kind of bit exaggerated. And that once I'd done that, I would then have a story of the Roman Empire that I could tell. And it took me decades to realise, first of all, that we can't know. You know, it's not that I can go through and say that's true and that can't be. We don't know whether it's true. My hunch is that most of them are somewhere on the spectrum between untrue and exaggerated, but I couldn't prove that. But what I can say is that the important thing about them is they get told and retold by Romans. And actually, the same stories about different emperors, you know, they get exactly the same treatment. And that what you're seeing there is not literal truth, but you're seeing truth at a kind of higher level. That what these stories are trying to capture is what imperial power is like.
Share with our listeners that you've mentioned the rose petals and being showered with rose petals. And it really did jump out at me as an acute example of something that doesn't have the ring of gospel truth about it.
No, it doesn't. It's a story told about the Emperor Elagabalus, about whom most people quite understandably have not heard. He's a teenage emperor from Syria originally, at the beginning of the 3rd century CE. And an awful lot of what we know about the Roman Empire in popular culture comes much earlier than that. I, Claudius, you know, whether it's the movie or the novels or whatever, 1st century CE, and the usual cast of characters. You know. Now, actually, there's very interesting stories from much later, and this is one of them. The whole reign of this kid is treated as if it is an example of about the worst thing that could ever happen to the Roman Empire, to be ruled by this kid. What you see is a whole series of anecdotes which try in different ways to capture his villainy. And the one I think that has got kind of currency and has appealed to writers and artists for since is he invites people to dinner. And at the end of the evening, in a traditional Roman way, and Nero had done this before, the ceiling opens and rose petals fall out on top of the guests. You know, that's what an imperial dinner party, that's what it looks like. Except in Elagabalus's case, there are so many rose petals that the guests smother and die. Right? Now, it doesn't take much to say, us sitting here now and saying, I wonder if that was true, isn't really getting to the point of this. And what I've tried to do in the book is to say, what is that story telling us? Why does it hit home when we're thinking about Elagabalus or about the emperor in general? And I think it hits home because it's saying, when the emperor is really generous to you, that's when he's his most deadly, right? Imperial cruelty is not just about knives in the back in dark corridors. The emperor can kill you literally by being kind. Now, at that point, you start to begin to get a glimpse of the sort of way that the morality that governs the imperial palace, the morality that governs the autocrat and those who surround him, just how perverted it could be. These guys, they try to be kind, but it's deadly.
That does really nicely bring us back to that idea of classical studies being an act of rereading, an act of looking at it and interrogating. Are there stories that endure that you think create a kind of damaging understanding of the Roman Empire, or at the very least a not useful one? You know, ancient Rome seems to me to have lots of bad fans who've learned the wrong lesson from it.
And I suppose we saw that a few months ago, didn't we, with the that TikTok meme of the woman and then many times replicated, the woman asking her bloke how many times he thought about the Roman Empire. And, you know, and he said, oh, about 15 times a day or something.
Yeah, that is wild.
And you thought, A, I don't believe that. But B, you thought, in what way is that being a bad fan? And it did seem to me there, and I think this picks up what you're asking, that the Roman Empire has become, partly because it is sort of officially classical, it's become a kind of safe space where you can have macho fantasies. You know, that what you're doing is you're thinking about a world in which it's okay to imagine invading people in your little skirts with your shield and your spear, and you're going to build roads and you're going to build bridges and aqueducts, and you're going to be really male. that is part of what the Roman Empire is about. You can't deny that. But I thought, if somebody said on TikTok, I think about the Third Reich every day, you'd think... This is not good. But you can say, I think about the Roman Empire, and you're allowed. No, of course, you're only thinking about one bit of the Roman Empire. You know, you're never imagining yourself as poor. You're never imagining yourself as a slave. They imagine themselves as generals and emperors, of course. And so, you know, I found it quite cheering because I thought, well, there's work to be done here because there are people who are kind of interested. But maybe you could show them that it was actually even more interesting if they took a wider view. But you're right, you know, the Romans have been, and classics in general, have been good alibis. You know, go back to the 17th, 18th century, and you want to have a really raunchy painting with the kind of sex shown that you would never be allowed to actually show. You dress them up as nymphs and gods, and you can do anything, you know. So classics has been an alibi for being able to think about things that we perhaps shouldn't be thinking about in quite that way.
It is true. In pop culture, it's often a shorthand for a kind of idea about debauchery or an idea about the kind of respectable face of that.
Yes, you never quite know whether you're looking at these, let's say, in painting, these recreations of the Roman orgy. You know, are you looking at it to enjoy it, or are you looking at it to say, God, weren't those Romans dreadful? And, of course, you're doing a bit of both, aren't you? You know, nobody ever says, weren't those Romans dreadful, without having a slight sort of lurid fascination.
Mary Beard is on to you, faux Roman students. Yes. She sees right through this. I have to ask, you're well and truly on the record as being no great fan of Marcus Aurelius.
This will now get me into trouble, as it always does, but I'm already in trouble, so there's no point in trying to escape.
Lean into it.
I have to say I admire him. I admire him for being 2,000 years on a bestseller. And, you know, when I look at the Amazon charts in Roman culture, he almost always outsells me. And, you know, fair cop. I'm both impressed and slightly jealous, all right? I think he's interesting in all kinds of ways. What I can't stand is the bestseller, which is the Meditations. Mm. You know, his jottings to himself are vaguely based on Stoic philosophy that he put in his little notebook, and somehow, we don't know how, they got published, copied and circulated. And I can't stand them because they're such dreadful clichés, right? And yet they have this aura of almost kind of legitimate sexiness because they're written by a Roman emperor, you know, and it is said that President Clinton used to have a copy of Marcus Aurelius's Meditations on his bedside table. Heaven knows what he learned from them. I mean, yeah, I'm going to parody slightly, but, you know, they say things like, when you get up in the morning, always think what you're going to do that day. Oh. Have a plan. And you think, really? You know?
This is so banal. It is. It's the little book of karma of its day. It happens to be written by a Roman emperor.
Yeah. And it shows you that the Roman Empire, in different ways, and Roman emperors in particular, still have something going for them. Because it's written by a Roman emperor, you know, that people think, this is interesting. And, you know, there's Clinton, head of the Western world, as it were, you might say. Once he got by his bed, the self-help clichés of a 2,000-year-old head of the Western world. I think it's all a bit more commercial, though. I think that, you know, why does Marcus Aurelius still sell in great quantities? Partly because publishers can absolutely market him without ever having to pay him any royalties.
That's true. I think you'd be a very lovely author for a publisher to work with, but you'd still be higher maintenance than Marcus Aurelius.
I think I would. There's nothing better than a dead bestseller, I'm afraid.
It's a pretty good thing to embrace. I just wonder whether those countless heterosexual men on TikTok who are thinking about ancient Rome 15 times a day, I wonder if you offered therapy to men who are otherwise uncomfortable to go to therapy through the lens of the advice of ancient Rome. I think you're onto a winner.
And I think possibly that's a market to which Marcus Aurelius is already playing.
I think that's possibly right. I have no doubt of the therapeutic power of the work that you do, and I'm so grateful to you
for
talking to me today.
Thanks very much. Thank you.
Mary Beard's many wonderful books can be found at your favourite independent bookstores. Marcus Aurelius probably can too, but focus on Mary Beard for now.
From the Saturday Paper comes The Food, a free weekly newsletter featuring curated recipes from some of the country's leading chefs, including Andrew McConnell, Otama Carey, David Moyle, and Karen Martini. Cook what they cook by subscribing today at thesaturdaypaper.com.au/newsletters.
Before we go, I wanted to rave about the novel that I'm reading at the moment. I'm having a great time with Sarah Sasson's debut novel, Tidelines. It's about grief and loss and the stories we tell ourselves, and it's crazy talented for a first-time effort. As ever, you can find that recommendation and all others we mentioned wherever you buy books. That's it for this week's show. Like, subscribe, share, review. Do people still tweet? Do that. Read This is produced and edited by Clara Ames. Mixing and original compositions by Zoltan Fetcher. Thanks for listening. See you next week.